Boston, treating it like a personal victory. He dropped to his knees and touched his forehead to the ground. Allahu Akbar, he exclaimed, repeating it three times. God is great. God is great. God is great. It was the first time in 11 days when I felt like I'd had any influence. Getting to his feet again, Ali studied me closely. I was sweating, pointedly not looking in Nigel's direction. Ali seemed to read the disconnect between us. His voice grew stern, the words directed at me. He said, "This is not a game, you know. It is a serious thing." I nodded, trying to appear humble and capable of great piety. "Yes, of course, my brother," I said. "We understand." "It is set then, inshallah," he said. "You can prepare, and then at 11 o'clock, you will become Muslim." He left the room. Nigel slammed his Quran shut. His look was incredulous. "What the hell was that?" he said. "Aren't we going to discuss this?" "We had discussed it," I wanted to say. I said, "Nige, we have to do this. It's crazy, I know, but it's a way to keep ourselves alive." We were aware of the risks. In my Quran, I'd read the word that would apply to us, that would doom us if they ever figured out we were converting without believing. Hypocrites. Enemies from inside. Such enemies were considered far more evil and dangerous than those encountered on the battlefield. The Quran gave specific instructions for all pretenders to be killed. "They are the enemy, so beware of them," one verse read. "May Allah destroy them." Returning to the room, Ali instructed us each to choose a set of clothes from our sparse collection and come with him outside so we could wash in the courtyard. This alone felt like a new freedom, our willingness awarded with soap. The Muslim obsession with bodily cleanliness was only going to improve our situation, I thought. Nigel gathered up his clothes and followed me as I followed Ali down a narrow hallway, past the room where Abdi and the others were being held, past a small, unused kitchen, and out onto the concrete veranda that overlooked the yard. When I turned to look at him, he gave me a quick, surprising smile. "What are you getting us into now, Lintout?" he said under his breath. The question was both tender and bitter. It flashed through my mind that our story, what got set into motion that very first night Nigel and I spotted each other on the veranda in Addis, had been madness from the start. Mad love, mad confusion, and now maybe mad tragedy. What would have happened if I hadn't introduced myself? What if I just walked past him with my backpack and left him as he was? I was sure that in his mind, he'd rewritten the story and its outcome plenty of times. Slowly, we scrubbed our clothes in a plastic bucket under the hot sun, filling and refilling it at a tap located beneath a tall tree, leaving them out to dry. My nerves tingled. Despite the heat, my hands and feet felt cold. With Nigel, I'd been putting on bravado about converting, reminding him constantly of how much I already knew about Islamic cultures. I realized now that I knew very little. When it came to Islam, I'd been nothing more than a curious tourist. I felt quietly terrified of the decision I'd made. Back in the room, we were each given a can of tuna for lunch. We took turns washing in the bathroom. We combed our hair and put on our clean clothes, which had already dried. I wore my abaya over my old tank top and one of the pairs of men's jeans they'd given me. All of it smelled blessedly like detergent. We were stuck together, Nigel and I. It was as if we were preparing for a bizarre sort of wedding, getting ready to cross a threshold to seal our fates. I glanced at him, cleaner than he'd been in days, his hair wet and neatly parted on one side, looking wide-eyed and a little somber, and I felt an old flare of emotion. He had the beginnings of a beard, the scruff along his chin making him look grizzled, more suited to the drab, dusty purgatory of the house and walled yard. When we were a couple, I'd imagined so many possibilities for the two of us, so many ways our lives might play out separately or together. This was so far outside anything I might have conjured, ever. I folded my hijab beneath my chin so that it wrapped tightly around the perimeter of my face, my hair tucked carefully out of sight beneath. Nigel put on a black cotton shirt given to him by our captors. Ali returned to the room, having freshened his cologne and changed his own shirt. To become a Muslim, you need only to make one honest declaration of your faith. It does not need to happen in a mosque nor be witnessed by an imam. There's little ceremony involved. Converting is a simple matter of speaking two simple lines in Arabic, though the point is that you feel the conviction of those words in your heart. The sincerity is what matters. Nigel and I stood solemnly in the room with Ali as he recited the words of the Shahada in Arabic, and we mimicked them in slightly uneven unison. We made vows to accept Allah as our only God and Muhammad as his messenger. What I felt in that moment wasn't surrender and it wasn't defiance. It was simply a chess move. An uncertain knight slid two squares ahead and one to the side. It was not a betrayal of faith, of mine or Nigel's or theirs. It was a way to feel less foreign, and in feeling less foreign, we could be less afraid. We were doing what it took to survive. When it was all over, Ali left the room, and all the boys filed in and jubilantly shook Nigel's hand. "Mubarak," Jamal said to both of us. "Congratulations." Another nodded at me and called me sister. Young Yahya said something in Somali which Abdullah translated. "Jana, Jana. He is saying you will go to paradise." A door, maybe, had cracked open. In our new lives as Muslims, Ali had told us, we were no longer Nigel and Amanda. They'd given us new names. Nigel was dubbed Muhammad and I was to be called Maryam. In a few days, we'd be given new names again. This time, at our request, our captors would match them more closely to our old names. Nigel would be called Noah. My name would be Amina. I would live with it for a long time. Much later, I would look up its Arabic meaning. Amina was a girl who, above all, was supposed to be faithful and trustworthy. Chapter 21. Paradise. Now we needed to learn how to pray. From here on out, we'd be expected to pray each time our captors prayed. It would be the first thing we did upon waking, and the final thing we did before sleep. The conversion to Islam felt like a crossing. It was as if, for 11 days, Nigel and I had been floating on a ship in a harbor, and now we were coming ashore, with our captors lining the pier. I felt unsteady, disoriented. The boys were almost welcoming, showing us new courtesy. Instead of barging in and out of our room without warning, they stood in the doorway and waited for us to give permission for them to enter. Abdullah, it seemed, had appointed himself to be my teacher, while Jamal attached himself to Nigel. They doled out assignments, gave us lines to memorize from the Quran. They had us write down the movements of prayer. Thumbs by the ears, right arm folded over the left, and the words we were to recite as we went. I got the sense that teaching us was a way to relieve their own boredom. During our lessons, the other boys sometimes hovered in the doorway, listening as we fumbled over the Arabic, unable to hide their bemusement. Muslim prayers are performed in cycles called raka. Depending on the time of day, you go through the cycle either 2, 3, or 4 times, a bit like doing sun salutations in yoga. Each prayer includes motion. You stand, you kneel, you touch your forehead to the floor, and you sit back on your heels in contemplation before starting all over again. You recite Quranic verses from memory, each cycle beginning with the same 7 lines from the first chapter, but expanding from there to include other chapters. Surah, a chapter is called. The most facile Muslims can draw from the whole book of the Quran, having committed every last one of the book's 114 chapters, over 6,200 verses in all, to memory. I prayed awkwardly. I held my thumbs at the wrong angle next to my ears or forgot to keep my toes tucked beneath me when I touched my forehead to the ground. The Arabic words got tangled in my head, unhitched as they were from any sort of meaning. There were a few phrases I'd picked up during my time in Iraq, but for the most part, we were learning syllables more than sentences, stringing them together like beads, a couple of words at a time. Bismillahir Rahman al-Rahim, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. I recognized how gentle it could sound, the lulling lift and fall of the words, how the lines might flow together like waves, until one got caught in my head and refused to come out. Ara, Arahim? Abdullah caught the question in my tone. He leaned in close for a split second. No, he snapped. Wrong. He was not a patient teacher. When it came to spoken Arabic, my copy of the Quran was no help whatsoever, since the Arabic was presented in indecipherable script, with nothing spelled out phonetically. So Abdullah chanted breathlessly, and I scrawled notes in my notebook so I could practice it all later. On the other side of the room, Jamal sat close to Nigel, his knees pulled up to his lanky body, taking him through new verses with painstaking care. I looked at Abdullah. Can you do that last part again, please? More slowly? He shook his head and got to his feet, seeming to signal that our lesson was over. You are bad, Amina, he said gravely, chucking his chin toward Nigel. Noah, as if he were the model student, the preferable one. He went on to repeat the verse in a last merciless whoosh of Arabic, and then, relishing his own ability to pronounce English, he said nice and slowly, You are a very stupid woman. One thing about Islam is that paradise always beckons. Life is oriented toward the afterlife. Whatever pleasures you miss out on in this world, whatever comfort or richness or beauty is absent from your days and years, you will find it upon entering paradise where pain, grit, and war disappear altogether. Paradise is a vast, perfect garden. It's a place where everyone wears pretty robes, where there are lavish banquets and comfortable couches decorated with jewels. There are trees and musky mountains and cool valleys lined by rivers. Paradise is so perfect that the fruit there never rots and a person stays 33 years old forever. It is the finish line to all earthly misery, an entryway into perpetual bliss. According to the Quran, angels wait at each of its 8 gates, congratulating new arrivals. Peace unto you for all that ye persevered in patience, they say. Now how excellent is the final home. The more I read about paradise, the more I understood that this was what the boys waited for, what they worked toward with their prayer, as if they had a giant layaway plan for their dreams, paid forward in daily devotion until it came time to meet the angels. Helpfully, my Quran came annotated. Different passages were accompanied by long footnotes in English, quoting the Muslim Hadith, the ancient text that recorded what the Prophet Muhammad did and said and taught during his life. The Hadith added context and detail to the Word of God as written in the Quran. For me, reading in our concrete room in the electric house, the footnotes helped answer some of my questions. They told instructive little stories and, together with a Quran, made clear what a person does in this life matters immensely in the next. Paradise, it is said, has 7 levels, with the top level further divided into 100 degrees, and the highest spots reserved for the most righteous. The boys in our house, with nothing to distract them and no responsibilities beyond guarding me and Nigel, were trying to land themselves a good spot in the afterlife. They had plenty of time to work on their faith, to bank their virtue in anticipation of Judgment Day. If Abdullah had any suspicion about my sincerity as a Muslim, he didn't show it. Instead, he passed hours sitting across from me, listening to my Arabic with intense, unblinking concentration, his eyes fixed on my face as I took baby steps with my chanting. If I managed to get through a few minutes of recitation without a single stammer or pause, he'd commend me. You are very smart, he'd say. This is good. But it was only a matter of minutes, usually, before I'd screw something up. Abdullah's mood would flip instantly. He'd pounce on my failures, seething with new rage. When I looked up at him, trying to understand what I'd done wrong, he'd scream, "Look down," and often lift a hand, threatening to hit me. His hands, I noticed, were unusually large. When he was gone, Nigel and I wondered aloud whether he was just power tripping or possibly mentally ill. Either way, he seemed to believe that he owned me. As the third week of our captivity began, I felt grateful for the challenge of learning both a new language and a new religion. It helped to fill the days. When we were left alone, Nigel and I compared notes on what we were discovering inside the Quran. He was focused on the idea that Allah had a lot of rules regarding promises and oaths. If you swore something on Allah's name, you were obligated to fulfill the promise. His goal was to get one of the leaders to swear on Allah that they'd let us go. Even in the off hours, I could hear the group of boys continuing to chant from the Quran as they sat outside on the patio, their voices braiding together in a long-lasting hum. How, I wondered, did they stay so focused? Did their beliefs really run that deep? I would have expected that one of the older guards, the captain or Ali, would lead the prayers, but it was the small, serene Hassam, who at 16 was one of the youngest in the group. Hassam's father, Jamal had explained to us, was an imam at a mosque. As a result, Hassam knew more of the Quran than anybody else in the house, and thus was put in the pole position for prayers, standing at the front, facing Mecca, and leading the recitations, while the rest of the household stood in lines behind him. Through our spy hole in the bathroom vent, I watched him inhabit the role of an elder. He sang the prayers in a loud, clear voice, exaggerating his hand motions so everyone could follow along. Nigel and I were expected to pray in our room, with Nigel standing ahead of me because he was a man and thus our leader. Every so often, Jamal came in and invited Nigel to join the rest of them outside. Nigel understood that he couldn't say no and that it was a chance to get some fresh air. He'd look at me a bit apologetically, knowing that, as a female, I'd probably never be invited to pray outside, and then he'd go. Left alone, I skipped my prayers altogether. Knowing my captors were occupied and wouldn't bother me, I was happy to stare at a wall. "This isn't good. You can't keep human beings like this," said Donald Trump one evening after stepping into our room and taking stock of our grungy mattresses, the black mold along the back wall. Along with an expression of mild outrage, he wore a pink long-sleeve dress shirt and baggy trousers hemmed to the proportions dictated by the hadith, one hand span above his ankles, to keep the fabric from brushing the ground. He kicked at a roach crossing the floor. Despite his feigned disapproval, Donald was one of the leaders of the group holding us. We were sure about that. Donald drove in every 5 or 6 days with supplies from the city. Ali, for reasons we'd never know, had disappeared sometime during the third week. Donald's real name was Muhammad, but we already had one Muhammad in the house, and besides that, he handled the household money and was more westernized than the others. His English wasn't perfect, but he talked a good worldly game. He aligned himself with me and Nigel, trotting out stories from what apparently had been extensive travels in Europe. He told us he'd spent time living in Germany. He rhapsodized about the olive oil in Italy, how it tastes more amazing than olive oil from anywhere else in the world. He'd seen things. He knew things. He wanted us to know that he knew things. He seemed to think it set him apart. That evening, he showed up with 2 cans of warm Coke and handed one to each of us. He squatted down for a chat, his face lit by the bulb overhead. "These people, you know, they're uneducated," he said. "They just want money." "We don't have money to give them," I responded. "There is no money." I sipped my Coke slowly like a cocktail. Donald lifted his shoulders and then let them fall. "If it was up to me, you would go in 1 week." He smiled and tilted his head. "No, you would go in 1 hour." Not one part of me believed him. It was midway through September, approaching the 1-month anniversary of our kidnapping. It was also Ramadan, the holy month. Ramadan was meant to reinforce purity and patience. There were extra prayers. Everyone fasted while the sun was up, a condition that made little difference to me and Nigel since we were eating only twice a day anyway. Each morning before sunup, we were brought a few things by Hassam or Jamal, usually some canned tuna and a plastic bag of what looked to be hot dog buns. Though in a Muslim country, given the Quran's prohibition on pork, surely they were meant to hold something else. We ate without enthusiasm and didn't drink or eat again until nighttime when a similar meal arrived. My body felt uninterested in the food set before me. My muscles were going slack after weeks of sitting. We drank water and craved the tea, energizing in its sweetness, that came with our meals. What I longed for most was a single square of chocolate. Sometimes as Nigel dozed on his mattress, I told him long made-up stories, personal fairy tales, that culminated each time with me happening upon a whole pound of dark chocolate or a big pile of M&Ms and eating it all up. Or I posed questions. Would you rather have a piece of chocolate cake or a hot fudge sundae? A hot fudge sundae or a bag of Hershey Kisses? He didn't answer and I didn't care. I fanned the air with my hand to stay cool. In my version of paradise, the air was always cold and the rivers ran with candy. Meanwhile, the sweat pooled inside my bra cups, steaming my breasts until the skin grew spongy and raw. Nigel hadn't worn pants in weeks, having adopted the Somali man skirt to keep himself cool. I had recently stopped wearing jeans and the black abaya and instead donned a long, shapeless dress made of thick red polyester that Donald had brought me during an earlier visit. I couldn't bring myself to remove the bra. It felt like protection. Before leaving our room after his visits, Donald always asked us what we needed from the market. Anticipating the question, I, at one point, made a list in my notebook to hand over the next time he surfaced, tossing in a few fantasy items for my own amusement. Soap, aspirin, chocolate bars, exercise bike, cotton buds for cleaning the ears, a television. He studied the page when I passed it to him, looking puzzled. I pointed to each item and pronounced the word slowly. Exercise bike. Ah, yes, yes, he said, not wanting to lose face by admitting he didn't understand. Do you think you could find one of those in the market, Mohammed? Yes, I think so, I think so. A few days later, he brought us the soap and some acetaminophen tablets, so large they looked like horse pills, plus a packet of Q-tips and a pair of small scissors so that Nigel could trim his facial hair. I asked Donald for a new bra and some books in English for us to read. Nigel and I begged him, actually, for the books. More so than our bodies, our minds were beginning to starve. There was something else I needed to discuss with Donald. I cringed to even think of it, but it was becoming necessary to address. My period was 2 weeks late. I'd had my fling with the fickle-hearted bureau chief before leaving Baghdad, that one bit of bodily distraction, the one concession to my neediness in a war zone, and now, in pretty much the worst imaginable circumstances, it was catching up with me. I'd never been pregnant, so I had no idea what it might feel like. Was the aching in my hips some sort of symptom? Did the malaise I feel, sweating through the hot afternoons, have nothing to do with my surrounding and everything to do with a kernel of life, another little hostage inside me? I wasn't sure what it meant or how to feel about it. I just knew it was a secret I couldn't, or shouldn't, try to keep. Tactfully, Nigel asked permission to leave the room so I could talk alone with Donald. We discussed how I should handle it, thinking it best that Nigel not be present. Donald, I figured, having lived in Germany, was the most likely of our captors to handle the news without invoking all sorts of moralistic disgust. Still, I worried what he'd do. On his forehead, Donald had a prayer mark, a dark, leathery-looking callus caused by the frequency and vigor with which he put his head to the ground. Some devout Muslims cultivated these as a source of pride, a sign of their steadfastness. Mohammed, I said, my voice faltering a little, I have something to tell you. I watched his expression grow serious, picking up on my tone. There was no turning back. Before I became a good woman, a Muslim woman, I had sexual relations out of wedlock with somebody in Baghdad. I dropped my gaze to the floor before continuing. I explained the situation as if somebody I barely knew, the infidel I'd once been, had borrowed my body and taken it out for a joyride. "I just need to know," I said, "if there will be a baby." I added inshallah for good measure, not sure what the desirable outcome would be. Was I saying, "God willing, I am pregnant," or, "Please just let me find out one way or the other"? I was 27 years old. I did not want to have a baby, especially not one fathered by a man into whose bed I'd wandered for the sole reason that I'd been deeply and pathetically lonely. Above all, I did not want to be pregnant in Somalia. Then again, beginning with the moment we were ambushed on the Afgoya Road, all rules had been rewritten, all priorities rearranged. Maybe, I thought, a pregnancy would help us get released. Maybe it would make me into a ticking time bomb. I'd walked my mind around in circles already. I imagined they'd at least need to take me to a doctor, and I could beg that doctor to call the authorities. When I really thought about it, I wasn't sure if there were any authorities in Somalia who were capable of getting us out. Donald received the news of my predicament calmly. "Okay, okay, okay," he said, seeming inconvenienced but not exactly angry. I felt like a teenager confessing to her dad. "Babies are a blessing from Allah," he added. A few days later, he returned with a paper bag. Inside the bag was a plastic cup with a lid that could be screwed tightly shut. "For your pee-pee," he said. Nigel and I snickered about the word pee-pee when he left. Where had he learned it? We laughed at absolutely everything we could. Any little fart or hiccup we produced, any strange thing one of our captors said. Otherwise, there was nothing at all to laugh about. In addition to the plastic cup, Donald had proudly brought us some English reading material. Stuff he'd found in a market stall. There was a college catalog for Malaysian students, printed by the British Education Board in Kuala Lumpur. It was dated 1994 and listed courses of study available for foreign exchange students at a variety of universities in the United Kingdom. We were also given a couple of grease-stained storybooks for Islamic children and a Times of London reader from 1981 that had gone dark with mold. Inexplicably, he'd brought us a watch, a cheap-looking black men's digital watch, made in China, as if knowing the hour of the day would make life better. Nigel and I laughed at all of this before falling back into the morose silence that governs so much of our time. When I was ready, I went into the bathroom, peed in the cup, screwed the lid on, and passed it back to Donald, who got into his car with it and drove off. That evening, when I prayed, I wasn't sure what to pray for. Chapter 22. Today's a good day. I watched Nigel's hands. Despite the heat and the grime, they were clean, his fingernails neatly trimmed, the Somali dust scrubbed from the furrows of his knuckles. He was fastidious. He always had been. Visiting him in Australia, I'd watched him wash his face in the mornings, floss his teeth, and carefully unfold his clothes. When we'd gone camping on an island off the Queensland coast, he'd been the one to shake the sand out of our sleeping bags and tidy up our tent, creating order out of my piles. Here, Nigel's hands were the cleanest part of him. This was due to the wudu, the ritual washing that went on before each of the 5 prayer sessions. Jamal had taught us the wudu just after we converted. You washed your hands 3 times, then swished water through your mouth 3 times, then snorted water through your nostrils, then splashed more of it over your face, arms, head, ears, and finally your feet. Nigel and I performed our ablutions in the bathroom separately, using fresh water from the brown bucket which the boys filled at the tap outside. The boys holding us all washed out in the courtyard or in their own bathroom, in a different part of the house, and so, it seemed, did the 3 Somali captives, since Nigel and I had this bathroom to ourselves. I always skipped over the nostril washing, but took care to make fake snorting sounds in case anyone was listening. The wudu was important. It purified you before you talked to God. Judging from the outcome, Nigel took to his wudu like a surgeon prepping for the OR. It was one part of Islam that seemed to agree with him. Cleanliness is half of faith, the Prophet had told his followers. On this front, Nigel, at least when it came to his hands, was in good shape. I watched his hands because they were something to watch in a room where there was nothing to watch. Sometimes we tracked insects as they climbed the iron window grate. Once, looking outside, we saw a fat brown snake, maybe 8 feet long, rippling through the sand in the alleyway behind the house. Otherwise, there was little to see. I was remembering how, what seemed like a long time ago, Nigel's hands had given me both pleasure and comfort. They were capable hands. Hands that had held hammers and squared off timber, staying busy until a whole house, floor and rafters and roof, was built. In the confines of our room, I saw his hands as an extension of our brains and our bodies, desperate for a project, a purpose. One afternoon during the extra hot time when our captors usually took a siesta, Nigel went over to the plastic bags where we kept our supplies. He rummaged intently through his bag, driven by some unspoken idea. Within the hour we were playing backgammon, Nigel had crafted playing pieces from our Q-tips, one of us using the cotton nubs, the other using pieces of the plastic handles which he'd clipped with his beard-trimming scissors. On a sheet from his notebook, he'd drawn two rows of razoring triangles and then, using a couple of the acetaminophen tablets and the scissors, carved a set of working dice, itty-bitty white cubes with tiny numbers written on the sides in pen. We played for hours, and then we played for days. He won, I won. We played rapid-fire and without much conversation or commentary, like two monkeys in some deprivation-oriented psych experiment. If we heard footsteps in the hallway, we quickly slid everything under my mattress. Games, like so many other things that might divert us, were considered haram. We felt sure they'd punish us if they knew. Donald showed up one day and handed me a slip of paper with the name of a pharmacy on top. I saw my age listed next to the name of a Somali woman, an alias he'd used to submit my urine sample. "No baby," he said. "Allahu Akbar," I said instantly, though it was clear from the look on Donald's face that this was the wrong thing to say. "You didn't thank God for sparing you a baby, because a baby was a blessing, and blessings were things you hung on to, no matter what." Still, I was not pregnant. It was a false alarm, even though my period hadn't come. It seemed I was just stressed, right down through my hormones. The news felt like a relief, though a relief with disappointment pinned to its backside. I couldn't help feeling a little more alone. Trailing behind the disappointment, like a buzzing little motorcycle, was the faint and cloying memory of sex, a luxury of sensation that seemed almost unreal. Ramadan came to an end in early October. Our captors celebrated the breaking of the fast, the holiday of Eid, with a meal of stewed goat. Nigel and I were given a small plate to share, along with a few sticky dates, a plate of cookies covered in a thick, sugary glaze, and even some toffees. Between us, we had one spoon, which Nigel, in a courtly move, passed to me to use. The goat meat was delicious, boiled and tender and served on a heap of oily rice. Afterward, it cramped our stomachs and pulsed savagely through our intestines. We swapped shifts on the toilet and felt ourselves growing dizzy and dehydrated. Despite ourselves, we ate the toffees instead of saving them for when we were well. They made puddles of sweetness on our tongues. We tried to ignore the fact that our world had shrunk down to the size of our little pain reliever dice. 5 weeks after being captured, I worked at being cheery. "Today's going to be a good day," I'd say to Nigel when we were awoken by the muezzin's first call. Almost always, he pretended like he didn't hear me. There was nothing good about our days. We both knew it, but for me, being hopeful felt necessary, like pounding a fist on the wall in case somebody might hear it. Look, I said one day, I can't handle the silence. We were on our mats. He was facing the wall. He said nothing. I felt a swell of emotion. Nige, I said, we need each other. We have to keep talking. It makes me crazy when you don't say anything. This prompted him to roll over, looking aggrieved. You think, he said, that if I fucking talk, it's going to be easier for you? A second passed. Do you really think I care about making this easier for you? We were like an old couple, a very old couple, our lust long extinguished, our affection worn away by constant togetherness. We lived like neighbors stuck for decades on the same cul-de-sac, breathing a resentful familiarity. It wasn't helped by the fact that despite our misery, we were too afraid to touch. We never once hugged or held hands or delivered the other person a reassuring pat on the shoulder. When Nigel was brought outside to pray with the boys, he no longer looked sheepish about it. He didn't get rushed back to the room when prayers were over. One day I heard him laughing on the veranda. I could hear them laughing all together as a group. When he got back, I asked what was funny. Oh, nothing, he said, climbing back onto his mattress, tired of me already. I watched him close his eyes. Nigel had been helping Jamal with his English every day, teaching him vocabulary words. They seemed almost like buddies, while Abdullah, my tutor, only got creepier. During lessons, he'd started brushing a hand as if by accident against my knee or shoulder any time he reached over to turn a page or point to something in my Quran. One day, Jamal came in bearing a surprise plate of fried fish, a gift from Donald, who was eating outside on the patio with the boys. As he set the plate down, Jamal attempted a joke. He looked at me, smiled, and puffed his cheeks out comically, as though to indicate that if I kept eating, I would put on weight. Nigel instantly roared with laughter. Amina is fat, he said, emphasizing the word in the same exaggerated tone he used when running through vocabulary with Jamal. Yes, fat. Jamal started to giggle. Nigel laughed harder. The cruelty of it rocked me. I went into the bathroom and shut the door. I didn't care what Nigel thought of my body at this point, if that was even the joke. It was the allegiance I didn't like, the possibility that he could switch sides, that I couldn't make him laugh, but those boys could. Returning to my mat, I tallied all the ways Nigel had disappointed me. I made a list of his weaknesses. Then I made a second list, the one with which I defended myself against whatever he was tallying up about me over on his mat, all the things that made me detestable and at fault. In my mind, we had a vicious screaming fight. We yelled, "Fuck you," and pounded each other's chests until we ran out of steam. Then we sobbed in each other's arms and vowed to do better. All this happened without a word, without anyone getting up from his or her mattress, without an actual tear. But somehow it helped. Over the course of the second month, they moved us multiple times, shifting us in and out of the electric house, bringing us to a bigger place not far away for a couple of weeks, then back to electric house, and then finally, for reasons we didn't know, to the new house again. They moved us at night, crammed into Ahmed's Suzuki, the boys having rewrapped their faces in scarves with extra rounds of ammo hung over their shoulders, gun barrels filling the air around our heads. They ran a second trip to bring Abdi and the other two Somalis to each location. Coming and going, we never saw another soul on the road. I had caught glimpses of Abdi and the others in the hallway at Electric House. I could hear them murmuring prayers and sometimes spotted one of them returning from the bathroom. They looked ragged, unhealthy, slumped over with depression. From what I could see, the room they were kept in was completely dark. Abdi sometimes sat in the threshold, reading his Quran in the light from the hall. A few times I peered out and flashed him the hand sign for okay, as in, you okay? Each time he shook his head looking forlorn. He touched his belly to show that he was hungry, that they weren't being fed. Before we left the electric house for good, a couple of the boys marched me and Nigel out into the courtyard, where Ahmed, Romeo, Donald, and Adam stood with a video camera set up on a tripod. The boys had covered themselves with their scarves. Brandishing their guns, they surrounded us while Nigel and I knelt on a mat. With the camera running, they coached us to make positive statements about Islam, to urge our governments to pay the ransom. They didn't have us say the amount they were demanding out loud, but that was all I could think about. I'd heard it from our captors many times now. 1.5 million for one hostage, 3 million for two. Back in my waitressing days, I announced drink specials the same way. They filmed multiple takes, having us repeat the words over and over. The video, I knew, was bound for television. I tried to picture my family watching it. What would they see? Me and Nigel in a semicircle of menacing soldiers and guns. I was pale but not unhealthy. My eyes watered constantly due to the fact that I wore contact lenses and, without contact solution, had been rinsing them in the unsterilized bucket water. I pictured my parents watching the screen, studying what they saw. I kept my shoulders squared even as Ahmed told me to look at the ground. When I said my lines, I tried to inject some intensity into my voice, a message designed for my parents to show them I was not crumbling. "Good, good," said Ahmed finally. He shut off the camera and then let us linger outside in the sun a while. Much later, I'd learned that the videotape would find its way to Al Jazeera and that the network would release only part of it to the international media, and, at least in Canada, with no audio. A clip played on the news at home not long after it was filmed. My parents would see about 9 seconds of me, lips moving, eyes down, fully cloaked in the garb of a modest Muslim woman, my voice lost beneath the newscaster's drone. On the final drive away from Electric House, one good thing happened. Nigel reached into the dark space between us and, without anyone noticing, spent 5 minutes holding my hand. The new house was the one we called Escape House, but not until later. Our room there was huge, the size of a living room rather than a bedroom. There were two brand new foam mattresses, a few inches thick, still in their plastic packaging, and also some mosquito netting which hung from nails in the wall on either side of the room, above each of the mattresses. The room had white tiled floors and two windows, both with metal shutters, the open spaces covered by decorative metal grills. One window opened out toward somebody's yard, which had a small shed made of corrugated tin and was locked with a padlock. The second faced a narrow alleyway with a high whitewashed wall directly across the way. Every evening, one of the boys came in and pulled the shutters across our windows. In the morning, someone came to open them again. When no one was around, Nigel and I tried shaking the grills to see if they'd come loose, but they were anchored on four sides by concrete, totally solid. From time to time, I stuck a finger through the window grill to give some part of me a chance to feel the outside air. It's true, we might have yelled out those windows, and we might have been heard, but both Ahmed and Romeo had warned us that we were in a neighborhood full of Al-Shabaab loyalists. In other words, we were surrounded by enemies worse than our captors, since our captors were apparently a renegade group unaffiliated with the dominant extremists. Al-Shabaab, Romeo suggested, would be happy to take charge of our captivity, to sweep us up if we caught their attention. It was enough to keep me quiet. My mistrust was wrapped in more mistrust. Standing on the far left side of the window that looked out onto the alley, I could see over a fence and into the yard of another home, where one day I saw a woman pinning laundry to a clothesline. She wore a brightly printed, loose-fitting house dress and had her hair wrapped in a scarf that left her neck exposed. With her back to me, she moved slowly, as if killing time, happy with her solitude. She hung a white shirt and then another white shirt. She hung some granny-style women's underwear, a pale yellow dress made for a child, a couple of bright floral hijab, some men's trousers, and something that looked like a cotton nightshirt. When she was done, I could see her whole family floating on the line. It had been about 6 weeks since I'd been allowed to talk to my mother. I felt like she could hear my thoughts, though, when I directed them to her. I sent her thoughts every day. I told her to stay strong, and I heard her say it back to me. I could guess at what was going on at home. My parents had so few options. I knew they'd be eyeing their one asset, my dad and Perry's house in its Sylvan Lake subdivision, surrounded by the flower beds my father had spent years slavishly tending, thinking they'd sell it to raise ransom money. The thought of this, the guilt, made me queasy. From the first day, I drilled the point with my captors, our families couldn't pay. If this kidnapping was political, as they kept saying it was, then they were punishing the wrong people. Ahmed had reassured me many times, don't worry, we are only interested in money from your governments. We do not wish to harm your families. I believed it because I wanted to believe it, even as Nigel told me I was crazy. His family had more resources than mine. When they retired, his parents had sold their family farm at a profit. He thought they'd have at least enough money to negotiate with. What was left unsaid was that the money might cover his release, but not mine. On that last call with my mother, I tried to emphasize the idea that my parents should sit tight and not gamble with what little they had. I don't know what you guys are doing trying to get money together, but stop whatever you're doing, I said. Do not sell anything. It wasn't that I thought our governments would come up with any money. I was holding on to my one serious hope, the idea that we could exhaust our captors with inaction. Nigel and I were not starving. We had each other. For the most part, we were getting by. I still believed that waiting it out was our best strategy. Hamdi was the name of Jamal's sweetheart. She lived somewhere in Mogadishu. Jamal's mother had picked her out for him. Now that they were engaged, Jamal got to see her every once in a while. Before Ramadan, there had been an engagement party for the two families. Jamal had disappeared from the house for a couple of days, returning with a new haircut and a goofy look in his eyes. "How is Hamdi?" I asked. "Ah," he said, trying to swallow his grin. "So beautiful." When Eid arrived, Jamal had been allowed to send gifts to Hamdi. He bought her a new hijab and some chocolate, which seemed like a grown-up gesture for a teenager who, by his own admission, had never talked to a girl outside his family until 2 months ago. "Women, they are expensive," he declared. He was proud he could pronounce the word. He knew it would make us laugh. He seemed dazzled by his own prospects, marking out the time between now and the future. He explained that when it happened, the wedding, the marriage party, would be small, since big gatherings in Mogadishu sometimes drew the attention of Ethiopian troops. I got the feeling that Jamal was so excited about his wedding, he'd happily invite the whole city. But the two families didn't want to run the risk, which was okay with Jamal. He just wanted Hamdi. Nigel and I looked for excuses to mention Hamdi, if only to watch the emotion play out on Jamal's face. He was desperate to hear her name, but shy about saying it himself. Every so often he would go to the market for food, but would forget to buy the hot dog-shaped rolls that accompanied so many of our meals. "Oh, Hamdi," we'd sigh dramatically when he turned up without the bread. We mocked his daydreaming by raising our hands to our foreheads. Every time it made him laugh. Sometimes, looking out through the grills of our windows at what I could see of the outside world, I tried to imagine what Hamdi looked like. Was she tall or thin or heavy? Quiet or bold? Was she afraid of what was coming? Or did she long for it? I wondered how much Jamal knew about her, whether his excitement came from love or just the possibility of love. He never said so, but my guess was that thoughts of Hamdi were getting him through the long days in our house. In the meantime, he had discovered the college catalog Donald Trump had delivered to us as reading material, the one designed for Malaysian students bound for the UK. Each page bore a few pictures of university students dressed in clothing that was now outdated. The students carried books over pathways that butterflied through green quadrangles amid Gothic stone buildings. Jamal flipped through the pages one morning, studying the photos with fascination. He turned the book toward me so I could see a page that had caught his interest. There was a photo showing a group of students sitting by a small pond with a couple of swans gliding on the surface. "Is this like Canada?" he asked. "Well, yes, but that book is all British schools." I was sitting on my mattress. Nigel stood at the window, quietly reading the Quran. Jamal ran a finger over the English text as if reading it. His brow wrinkled. "I heard," he said, "that Canada is more beautiful than British. Because British, London, is more..." Searching his mind for the word, he pointed at the walls of the room, the ceiling. "Concrete?" "Yes, concrete. London is concrete." He wanted the world. I understood that. I felt him swaying toward it. "London is very pretty, Jamal," I said. "You'd like it. The buildings are very old. There are a lot of Muslims there." He seemed to think about this. "But," he said, lifting a finger professorially, "it is not a Muslim country, and it is better to live in a Muslim country." I was aware of what I was supposed to say next, that yes, of course, he was right. But because it was Jamal, I didn't. From our exhaustion, Nigel and I built a routine. We lived like a two-person family. We took on responsibilities. I poured the tea and Nigel washed our clothes. We took turns doing dishes in a bucket. Between us, we had two tin plates and a single spoon. With the food we were given, we made menus, eating our meals on a table-sized square of brown linoleum the boys had tossed into our room. Some days we ate the buns, followed by the tuna. Other days it was the tuna, followed by the buns. When we were given more, I'd use the straight edge of the spoon to chop up papaya and onion. And then Nigel, pretending to be a chef on a cooking program, would make an elaborate show of tossing it all together for his world-famous tuna salad. Occasionally, Jamal would bring us some wilted lettuce, and I'd use my waitress voice to crow about today's most elegant special, tuna salad served on a bed of lettuce. In the mornings, we straightened our beds and talked about what we'd dreamed while sleeping. I was having vivid dreams of old friends, people I hadn't thought about in years. Rihanna, my best friend from high school, made frequent appearances, and so did my family, grandparents, cousins, aunts. In my dreams, I was always free, but then, inside the dream, I would realize that none of it was real. Nigel and I talked in ways we never had. I described my shock and anger over how he'd lied to me in Ethiopia about being married, how crushed I had been. He took me through the months he'd spent in Australia, ending his marriage and feeling ashamed. He talked about his girlfriend in Scotland, Erica, who was Australian but was working as a chef on an estate there. She had a dog. She was a good person. He was missing her, torn up over having done something as stupid as run off to Africa, leaving her behind. We had honest conversations about money, about the net worth of our families. I thought my family could come up with about $50,000. He said his parents had access to more. We had faith that our families were talking to each other. Each night, as we were getting ready to sleep, I would turn to Nigel and say, "Now we are one day closer to being free." One morning, during the third week of October, the boys stormed our room. Abdullah, Mohammed, Young Yahya, and Hassam came running in almost at a sprint, startling us as we ate our breakfast on the floor. "You have to get up," Hassam said. I said, "What's happening?" "Get up," he said again, an edge in his voice. I noticed he was the only one without a gun. I felt my body start to shake. We were on our feet. Abdullah and Muhammad were tearing angrily through our belongings as if acting on a tip. They pulled everything out of our bags, overturning our mattresses, looking for something, though I couldn't guess what. We were blameless, I reminded myself that. Aside from the backgammon game, which was tucked away in one of the books and which I doubted they'd recognize anyway, we had nothing to hide. But I didn't know. How could I know what was wrong? The boys said nothing. Hassam stood grimly before us while the other three ripped through what little we had. They threw everything across the floor, and next they started carrying things from the room. My backpack went out, Nigel's camera bag. Our notebooks and pens and the plastic shopping bags with all our toiletries and clothes, all of it disappeared. And then Yahya picked up one end of Nigel's mattress and started to drag it toward the door. It dawned on me then what was happening. Abdullah unhooked the mosquito net from the wall on Nigel's side of the room and walked out. There was a smaller bedroom right next to the one we'd been staying in. We'd peeked into it plenty of times, coming and going from the bathroom down the hall. Through the wall, I could hear someone hammering, Abdullah most likely, rehanging the mosquito net in the next room. And then they were back, for Nigel. Guns leveled at his chest, motioning him toward the door. They were separating us. There was no explanation, no dialogue. I watched the back of his shirt as it moved away from me. There was no goodbye or anything. He was just gone. Chapter 23. Blame the Girl. I lay for a long time on my mattress, hoping that something would reverse itself. I waited for one of the boys to come in carrying Nigel's mattress and for someone else to hustle Nigel back through the door, maybe even apologetically, as if taking him away hadn't been the plan. I expected to hear some sort of noise, a shuffle, a creak, that would tell me the change was underway, that we were soon to resume our old spots, with our belongings, our routine. Instead, the house was quiet. The silence sat heavily in my ears. I was alone. 1 hour passed and then two. Alone felt like a new country. Alone felt like a new planet, one containing just me and my mattress with the blue-flowered cloth and the room's four walls, which seemed to have shot up like tall trees in a dark forest. Without Nigel, I had nothing to say, no one to look at. Nobody stirring the air. Alone in that big room, I was nothing but small. I couldn't guess why they'd chosen this day to separate us. Perhaps it had something to do with the fact that it had been 8 weeks since we'd been taken from the road, and there was no sign of a ransom payment. Frustration seemed to be mounting among our captors. The previous afternoon, there had been a commotion at the front of the house, and one or more of the leaders had shown up. We'd heard a long, intense conversation with Captain Skids on the patio. I wondered now whether the leaders had been instructing him to prepare for a long haul, informing him that we'd be house guests for longer than anticipated. Skids already seemed to view us as a burden. He expressed no curiosity about me and Nigel. He spoke no English and showed no warmth. I wondered whether it was he who'd insisted that Nigel and I be separated as an exertion of his control. An I'm the boss of the house move. Later that day, Jamal returned, carrying my backpack and the plastic bags with my toiletries, clothes, and the English books, dropping it all on the floor with a clunk of finality. I stared at the divot in the wall where the nail holding Nigel's mosquito netting had been. Had he been there to hear it, I would have said something encouraging and bright to stop the slide of emotions. I would have said, "Come on now, we just need to get through this morning." Or, "Tell me about the happiest birthday you ever celebrated." There seemed no point. My throat felt as if it had pinched shut. "Calm down," I told myself. "Calm down, calm down." Sitting up, I took out the spiral notebook they'd given me for my Islamic lessons and opened it to a fresh page. "Breadbeard," I wrote, using a nickname I'd had for Nigel in Ethiopia. "Stay strong. Don't give up. We are going to get out of here and be with our families again. I am just on the other side of the wall and will be sending love your way." I read the note a couple of times.